Good afternoon, everyone. The Select Committee on Health Innovation will now come to order. Judeline, please call the roll.
Chair Tuck.
Here.
Representatives Alvarez.
Here.
Andrade.
Here.
Borrero.
Here.
Casello.
Here.
Chamberlain.
Here.
Gonzalez Pittman.
Present.
Lopez J.
Here.
Lopez V.
Here.
Rayner.
Present.
Rizzo.
Here.
Silvers is excused. Steele.
Here.
Tremont.
Here.
And Williams.
Here.
A quorum is present, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judeline. Members, by your presence, we have a quorum. I want to welcome everybody back to our second meeting where we're going to have another robust discussion on healthcare policy. Just a quick reminder to the Dade delegation, go Noles, and all yourself. That was for you, Rizzo.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to ask everyone to please silence your cell phones and whatever else you may have. And just a quick overview of what we're going to be looking at today, how we got here, where we're going. Members, back in 2017, the legislature tasked the Department of Management Services with a bit of an experiment. We were aware that our insurers and HMOs in the state employee group plan contract with a large number of providers of the same type to give employees choices. But for one type of provider or service, there is a wide variation in price among in-network providers for the same services. Some cost more, some cost less. State employees had no knowledge of the prices and little ability to choose between different providers for the same service. Even if they could choose, they had no incentive to do so, since they pay the same cost sharing no matter what, and they certainly wouldn't share in any savings the state got for choosing a lower cost option. Enter shared savings programs. We require DMS to contract for two kinds of programs where employees can voluntarily shop for high quality services and share in the savings to the state when they choose lower cost options. Today, we will hear about how those programs work and how they're doing. The Department of Management Services is here to give us a briefing on those programs and on the state employee group health plan. We also have with us representatives from the companies running those programs for us, Employer Direct Healthcare and Healthcare Blue Book. Before we start, members, I'll ask everybody to hold your questions. We're going to do a little bit of a panel type of discussion, so everybody will present, and then we can ask questions to all the presenters. With us from DMS, we have Katie Parrish, the Deputy Secretary of Workforce Operations. Secretary Parrish, you're recognized whenever you're ready.
Okay, well, thank you, Chair Tuck and committee members, for having us here today. As Chair mentioned, my name is Katie Parrish. I serve as the Deputy Secretary of Workforce Operations at the Florida Department of Management Services. And it's a pleasure for me to be here with you today and talk with you about the Division of State Group Insurance and the Shared Savings Program. The Division of State Group Insurance administers the State Group Insurance Program for the state of Florida. It offers and manages a comprehensive package of health and welfare insurance benefits for active and retired state employees and their dependents, including a variety of health insurance options, flexible spending and health savings accounts, life insurance, dental, vision, and other supplemental insurance products, as well as our employee assistance program. The division contracts with third-party administrators to administer the health plans, which include HMO, PPO and PBM, or Pharmacy Benefits Manager Services. We also work closely with People First, the state of Florida's human resource information system, to help administer the program. During the 2023 plan year, our program covered approximately 340,000 lives. Our 55 participating employers include state agencies, state universities, and other statutorily defined entities. The division provides financial and administrative oversight for the $3.3 billion program with 34 FTE positions and an operating budget of just under $73 million. The State Group Insurance Program health plans are primarily self-funded. As health insurance costs have increased over time, so too have premiums. This slide shows the historical career service employee and employer premium contributions over the last several years. The left side reflects single coverage and the right side reflects family coverage. While employee contributions have remained largely unchanged for the past two decades, employer premiums continue to increase. So now we're going to talk a little bit about the Shared Savings Program. The Shared Savings Program was developed in an effort to promote healthcare cost transparency, increase member education, and ultimately lower costs. In 2017, the legislature directed DMS to procure two services. The first service focused on comprehensive pricing and inclusive services for surgical procedures. This is referred to as bundled surgical services. The second service focused on transparency and providing our members with accessible information concerning cost and quality of healthcare services and providers. This is referred to as transparency services. While our shared savings program vendors will be speaking more about their respective services, we wanted to go ahead and introduce you to the concepts. Bundled surgical services is an optional supplemental benefit available to all state group insurance program members at no additional cost to them. It is a healthcare concierge service that gives members access to an exclusive network of providers and coordinates the members' care for pre-planned non-emergency surgical procedures. These providers have directly contracted with the vendor at a pre-negotiated or bundled rate. By directly contracting with providers, costs are below reimbursement rates of traditional health plans. Savings realized through bundled surgical services include savings generated through provider agreements or the bundled claims payments, avoided procedures, and avoided surgical complications. The savings achieved when a member uses bundled surgical services is shared with the member in the form of a reward. The second component of the shared savings program relates to transparency services. Transparency services is a healthcare transparency tool that empowers members to search and compare in-network providers by cost and quality. Members can earn rewards by searching online and then having their medical procedure completed at one of the high-quality, low-cost facilities. When a member makes a cost-effective purchase for common healthcare services, the state shares a portion of that savings with the member. It's important to point out that in both bundled surgical and transparency services, that quality is a very important part of the equation. In both programs, there are specific criteria that providers and facilities must meet in order to be considered. Member rewards for both bundled surgical and transparency services are shared with the member by crediting the member's health savings account. All right, this slide shows us the process of how these two services work. You may notice that nowhere in the slide does it mention having to enroll to participate, and that's because all state group insurance participants have access to this benefit. If a member has a need and wants to take advantage of these services, the process starts with their phone. For bundled surgical services, the member calls the vendor and a patient care advocate is assigned. The member selects from the list of exclusive providers, the procedure is completed, and then the member earns a reward. For transparency services, For transparency services, the member visits the mobile application or website of the transparency services vendor. They shop for their procedure, complete their procedure at a green facility, which is a facility that has been identified as high quality and low cost, and then the member earns a reward. Any earned rewards are deposited into a member's health savings account, such as a healthcare flexible spending account or an FSA, a health savings account or HSA, or a health reimbursement account or HRA. These rewards can be used for future eligible out-of-pocket medical, dental, vision, and prescription drug costs. All right. This slide illustrates the total amount of rewards earned by members and the net savings to the state of Florida. Since the program began in 2019, bundled surgical and transparency services have saved the state of Florida over $44 million, and members have earned more than $10 million in rewards. For transparency services, there were nearly 39,000 procedures completed, with a little more than $7 million in member rewards and a net savings of over $25 million to the state of Florida. For bundled surgical services, there were around 1,500 procedures with $3.2 million in rewards to members and a net savings of nearly $20 million to the state. This graph shows us the number of procedures that the Shared Savings Program has covered beginning in the 2019 plan year through September of this year, 2023. It's important to note that bundled surgical services provide services that are exclusively for surgical interventions. Most common procedures include orthopedic, bariatric, and general surgeries, while transparency services includes both surgical and non-surgical interventions. Some examples include MRIs, x-rays, and CT scans. And this slide, the graphs illustrate each component's savings trends since the program began, showing member reward amounts relative to the net savings to the state. And this is going to conclude the department's portion of the presentation. We look forward to hearing from our vendors. Are there any questions?
Thank you so much, Secretary Parrish. Next up, we will have Bill Campine, the co-founder of and chief innovation officer for Healthcare Blue Book. Thank you for being here. When you're ready, you're recognized.
Can everybody hear? Are we good? Awesome. So I'd like to thank the chair and the committee for the opportunity to meet today. My name is Bill Campine. I am the co-founder at Healthcare Blue Book, and I serve as our chief innovation officer. For those of you who may not be familiar with Healthcare Blue Book, I'll just give you a little bit on our background. So since our founding in 2007, we have grown to become one of the largest providers of healthcare price and quality transparency solutions to state and municipal employers, to public employee trusts and self-insured employers. We are one of the, if not the largest provider of federal compliance, transparency compliance solutions to independent TPAs and regional payers. And through our Quantros brand of quality analytics, we provide patient-specific outcomes to hospital organizations and other provider organizations who use that data to understand not only the quality performance of their facilities, like hospitals or hospital outpatient departments or ambulatory surgery centers, but also to understand the performance of the doctors who actually work in those facilities. We'll talk a little bit about quality in a little while. Since 2019, we've had the privilege of partnering with DMS to provide the award-winning shared savings program, and look forward to sharing some of the details of that. What I thought I'd do today is just cut my time sort of in two parts. One is to spend some time talking a little bit about the problem that we solve using data in the, from the perspective of the shared savings program. And then second, to talk a little bit about some of the innovations and things that we do with our clients, right? Healthcare never stands still. The market doesn't stand still. We have to deal with consolidation. We have to deal with other trends that are happening in our local markets. As a result of that, we have to continue to evolve what we do to ensure that we can empower our plan clients to save money and to get better value for those employees and their family members. So let's start first by talking a little bit about the price problem. So how do patients experience price? Well, in-network prices, and I can tell you this is true of any geography, city in the United States, any network, in-network prices for common services vary from anywhere from 200% to 1,000%. So in a place like Tampa Bay, in-network price for something like a colonoscopy can run $1,000 to $7,000, or a shoulder MRI from about $400 to an excess of $2,600. If you, as a patient, don't know that price varies, and you don't know what you should pay, and you don't shop ahead of time, you are very likely going to overpay. And not only are you going to overpay and experience that from your out-of-pocket perspective, but the plan is going to overpay and significantly so. As the complexity of the service increases, the complexity for the consumer increases. And so the way I always sort of frame this problem is, again, in any network, any location in the United States, networks don't guarantee low cost and high quality. And so it's incumbent upon us to have the tools that empower consumers to understand differences in cost and quality and then navigate to better value. And so this is an example. Each one of these is a knee replacement in the Orlando area. What you're looking at is the allowed amount. So this is the total amount that was paid for the knee replacement after the in-network discount was applied. These run $12,000 to an excess of $60,000, so a 500% difference, roughly. On average, right, the difference in the lower 50% to the upper 50% is about $20,000. Now, what I think is interesting about this graph is the light blue is what doctors get paid. The dark blue is what the anesthesia group gets paid. The orange part is what goes to the facility. So most of the variability in cost, whether it's an inpatient service or an outpatient service, like an ACL repair that is done in a ASC or a HOPD, almost all that variability is happening in the facility. So where you go for care is going to determine the cost of that care. And the challenge in this, if you're a consumer, is many times that light blue section, those doctors work at several of those facilities. So if you just choose your doctor and you don't navigate beyond that, you could end up either paying directly or having the plan pay directly $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 too much for these common services. And so right at the heart of it, what we're trying to do within shared savings is to understand on a cost and quality basis, what are these differences, to navigate folks to better value and then to reward them for making better choices. I've put this slide in here related to the drug prices. Now, drug pricing and pharmaceuticals are not part of the state's shared savings program. But as I think about strategies and big opportunities and looking ahead and where our clients have gone over the past 4 or 5 years, the fastest growing cost for our employers is the pharmacy side of it. It's either in the PBM or it's with the specialty medications coming through the PBM or with the infused specialty medications like Remicade and those drugs that are being paid for through the medical benefit. We have this tendency to think that the pharmacy and the PBM expenditure are sort of exotic because we've got contracts and they're very complex. But when we look at the data the same way that we just looked at the medical data, we see exactly the same thing. For any given condition, most broad formularies have multiple drugs that are equivalently effective to treat that condition with very, very large differences in price. Sometimes there's a 300% difference in price that not only the patient pays, but the plan pays. Net of the rebates to that drug, it's still a 300% difference, and it's the exact same compound. And so these same principles that apply on the medical side can also apply to the pharmacy side in terms of helping patients navigate and get better value. Let's spend a minute and talk a little bit about the quality problem, because it is equally as important as the price problem. The way that I sort of frame this is, and this is true of hospitals, but you can think of the hospitals for inpatient, hospitals for outpatient, ambulatory surgery centers, and the doctors themselves. But the way I think about this is, most hospitals do most services. There are very few hospitals in the United States that are equally good at all of those services. So there are roughly 5,500 acute care hospitals. Approximately 3,200 of those hospitals do joint replacements. If you're in Tallahassee and you need a joint replacement as a patient, you need to understand what are the outcomes for patients that go into each of those hospitals specifically for a joint replacement. And the way that we do that is we use very, very large data sets. We actually, we don't use any self-reported data. We don't use any process metrics. We actually look at all the discharges for all the joint replacements or complex heart surgeries or other types of surgeries for each of those hospitals, and we evaluate those outcomes based on mortality, complications, and likelihood of readmission or other unanticipated events after the discharge. That allows us to rank all these hospitals, 3,200 across the United States, from the very best to the very worst, and be able to navigate patients appropriately. The easiest way to think about this is there's two different services, spinal surgery and gastrointestinal surgeries in the Miami area. The absolute best hospital for spinal surgery is in the 98th percentile out of all roughly 2,000 hospitals that do this nationally. However, when you look at their outcomes for gastrointestinal surgeries, they're in the bottom 10%, right? And so this is the inherent challenge that patients have. The desire sometimes is to carve hospitals out of the network. The problem that you see on the screen is if you carve out one hospital, you may be removing the absolute best hospital for spinal surgery. So it's incumbent then to navigate within the network to specific locations based on their individual service-related cost and quality. Same holds true for doctors. We do the same calculations, and we look at the outcomes for doctors, both for their inpatient care and for their outpatient care. We also do this for outpatient facilities like ambulatory surgery centers. We've talked a little bit about how the shared savings program works. I think Katie went through that in detail, but we require members to engage to actually shop for their service on Blue Book. We track that. We see where they've received their care, and if they use, in our parlance, a green facility, cost-effective, high-quality facility, they earn their reward, which is deposited into their account. From a visual perspective, how do we take this information, all of this data, and make it easy for a consumer to use? We provide very intuitive, color-coded, easy-to-use web applications and mobile applications. You can search a procedure like a total hip replacement in Jacksonville and immediately compare in-network providers sorted first by quality, second by cost, easy to identify those providers, for which if you use that provider, you will earn a shared savings incentive. Again, Katie, I think, had gone through a few of these results. I think it is an incredibly successful program. We've gone from roughly 3 million in plan savings from the first year to almost 7.5 in the fourth year. Engagement has been tremendous. I think we've grown from roughly 5,000 rewards earned to an excess of 11,000 rewards earned in 2022. The ROI in this program has grown from about 2.5 to 6.2 to 1. I think we're on track to hit that again this year, if not exceeded in this current calendar year. So let's take a minute just to talk a little bit about looking ahead, right? So as I said, you know, the healthcare industry doesn't stand still. It doesn't remain static. And as a result of that, our capabilities and our solutions have had to evolve to continue to support our employer clients and their members to capture more of those cases and capture those cases earlier in the care pathway. When I look back, if you look at the data over the past decade, care has moved from the inpatient into the outpatient environment. So inpatient surgeries are now being done in outpatient or ASCs, like joint replacements. Outpatient surgeries are now being done in offices, and that requires a new generation of cost and quality data to enable patients to navigate care in those different settings. Equally important, I think the evidence is pretty clear that consolidation is impacting cost and ultimately at the end of a care pathway for a surgery, impacting choices that are available to members. So I think back, you know, a decade ago for any given surgeon, if they're an orthopedic surgeon and you looked at the alternatives in terms of where they might do something like an ACL repair, there might have been five different locations, multiple hospitals and ASCs. As consolidation, hospitals have bought hospitals and physician practices and ASCs, the scope and the availability of those services has narrowed a little bit. And so it's important to get earlier and earlier in the care pathway to help that patient choose the right doctor and set of facilities from the beginning and to help them navigate that care pathway from the initial diagnosis all the way through the end of the pathway if it results in a surgery or post-surgical care. And so with respect to that, I just want to talk a little bit about a couple of strategies that have evolved, you know, for us and our leading clients over the past several years. I think the first principle here, and I had mentioned it earlier, from a shared savings perspective, for most employers, the fastest growing cost is on the pharmacy side. There is enormous price variability in these medications. And expanding services to cover both medical and pharmacy is another avenue for a significant amount of savings for the plan. As we analyze our client data, we look, for example, at a very open formulary. It's not uncommon for us to see 30, 40% savings opportunity if members would simply use the more cost-effective medications within their existing formulary. I think the second pillar or strategy that we tend to think about, again, and I had alluded to it a few minutes ago, is impacting member choices earlier in the care pathway. In order to do this, we have developed a sort of a new generation of quality metrics and utilization metrics to help members identify those physicians, first of all, that practice appropriately. So do they follow clinical guidelines? Do they overtreat? Do they operate twice as frequently as similar physicians in their area with a similar pattern, with a similar panel? What we want to do is guide patients to experts in an area that don't overtreat and don't deliver wasteful care. The second piece of it is to understand that physician's referral patterns. You go see a doctor, but they're going to refer you for imaging. And ultimately, they're going to choose a location if you have to have a surgery. The question is, can we guide patients initially to doctors that generally have more efficient or green, if you will, referral patterns? The last of it, the last piece of it is those outcomes. When we look at their patient-specific outcomes and we risk adjust those outcomes, are they in the top third for the hospitals they're using or in the green area in terms of their patient outcomes, whether those surgeries are done in the inpatient or outpatient environment? The last thing we do is we wrap concierge services as well as rewards around that initial selection of a physician, because we know we've now created the tools, be they pharmacy, be they quality, that allow us to engage the patient for the initial diagnosis and then guide them on that pathway for subsequent diagnostics or subsequent surgeries. When we look at it from that standpoint, no longer are we trying to help a patient make a decision at the time they need that surgery or at that MRI. We can get in front of it, and we can be much more efficient in affecting or impacting all the care that they have downstream from the initial diagnosis. And the concierge helps a lot in that context. The last element I'll offer just for consideration, and I think, you know, this was a hot topic prior to COVID. During COVID, you know, I think employers had other concerns that they were thinking about, but as we are beginning to see double-digit renewals in terms of the trend for employers, there is more and more interest in terms of taking these incentives, both positive incentives and negative incentives, and building them directly into the benefit design. So in other words, rather than rewarding somebody for using a green provider, we acknowledge that in every network, there's high-value care and there's low-value care, and we lower out-of-pocket if you use the high-value care, and we actually raise the out-of-pocket as opposed to having you face the status quo if you want to use low-value care. There's a lot of movement, but what that, in essence, requires is a fundamentally different benefit design. I will tell you, though, perhaps not at a state level, but with many smaller employers, regional employers, we see a lot of activity in this area. And so with that, I'll conclude my remarks, and I look forward to questions.
Thank you so much. Last but certainly not least, we have Ryan Burke, the Chief Network Officer for Employer Direct Healthcare. And Mr. Burke, whenever you're ready, you're recognized.
First, thank you all for taking on such an important topic in the state of Florida. Looking forward to going through some slides here. If I could figure out how to get it into presentation mode, IT is not my strong suit. So Employer Direct Healthcare, we really have two programs we're primarily known for, Surgery Plus and Cancer Care Direct. Both of them are looking to do very, very similar things, have a direct impact on a member in the moments that matter most to them, which are very stressful times in their lives that are very infrequent. We exist, and our mission is to transform access to excellent care for the moments that matter most. Right? Those are those infrequent moments. And the reason why is there's a tremendous variability between both quality of care received and the actual cost, what you pay for the surgery. And so we're trying to impact both of those with all of our solutions, Surgery Plus being the most recognizable with the state. You guys were absolutely an early adopter. We've grown quite a bit since first working with the state back in 2019 to now where we're north of 5 million members across a number of very notable clients, but of all different demographics, which I think fits really well with the state's population because that's not too different from what our client list looks like. So kind of getting to what we do. When you think of the traditional centers of excellence model, they were trying to solve for the exact same thing, quality and cost of care for surgical events. The problem is there's a lack of a practical nature to it because fundamentally they believe that everyone would need to get on a plane to have a surgery. COVID, I think, amplified that even more, that it's not really necessary. If you can get to the right surgeon, even within a practice, you can find great care in the local community. That makes the program more accessible. And then practically, people will then actually use it because putting a program in place that nobody uses, while it might be great at its core, doesn't actually drive results. We built a network of that allows us to cover north of 1,500 different surgical procedures, so anything you can plan, we can cover, and keeping people within a very short car drive to utilize that solution. Kind of taking it again, a case study, this is the client of our, a couple clients of ours here, and what we see is on the left-hand side, when folks had to leave Memphis, which was the headquarters of this large company, because we didn't have network options there, and go to Atlanta, they had 8 times lower utilization than that same employer's population that was in Atlanta and got to stay in Atlanta. We saw a similar thing up in Chicago area with a large employer headquartered in Bloomington. Folks didn't want to even drive 2.5 hours from Bloomington to Chicago where we had network. That utilization was 5 times lower than Dallas. That same employer, same population, same plan design, saw significantly more utilization because we had network in Dallas. Having that localized network and having a combination of all different types of facilities allows us to help anybody. It's very tough to tell a member no all the time because, no, we only do joint replacements, so we can't help you for your knee scope. Or, no, we only do spine fusions. We can't help you for your smaller, more conservative care. And that allows us to impact 13% of members that have those types of surgeries every single year. When we think about quality, that's always table stakes. That's first and foremost, because reducing the unit cost, which is critically important if we're going to keep allow healthcare to continue to be sustainable. So we have to reduce unit costs, but if you do so in the absence of quality, your long-run impact is increasing costs through complications, readmissions, and absenteeism. So we really focused on quality, and to do that, we brought in a panel of expert surgeons because we thought, what better way to figure out how to identify quality than to ask surgeons that are sought after by leading institutions to speak at panels because they've really been able to figure out how to do things better. And we asked them a simple question. If you had a friend or family member that needed a procedure that you were an absolute expert in, but they lived across the country, how would you help guide that member? Started by saying, first, you've got to limit the funnel. And so they came to us with what we thought to be pretty basic requirements. This picture on the left, where we required them to be board certified, fellowship trained, that extra year of training, no state sanctions, malpractice review, reputational review. Before we even get into the nitty-gritty stuff kind of on the right, just that pyramid you're seeing, that inverted pyramid, is actually in-network orthopedic surgeons in Tampa, Florida. So 75% of them were eliminated just by that pre-screening. From there, it's critically important that we understand what types of volumes they do by CPT code. So the knee replacement surgeon in our network might not be the same surgeon that we allow to do a hip replacement because they might just not do enough of them for them to be proficient and have the programs built. Then from there, we look at their hospital's quality. And what we tend to find is when you identify the right surgeon, the procedures they do at the hospital or the surgery center, they do really, really well and have great scores because that surgeon helped build those pathways and protocols with the facility. We then track our outcomes. So it's an example here across over 1,500 joint replacements. We had a complication readmission rate combined of 0.32%, markedly lower than the industry average based on peer-reviewed journals and publications. With that, we also, I'd like to call out that we did 61% of those 1,500-plus joint replacements successfully in a surgery center versus a hospital. Of those 61%, we had zero bounce backs, readmissions, complications. So getting them to the appropriate setting for their care, and then also surgical avoidance is key because we never want to do a procedure that's not necessary. And we've really grown in Florida as well. We're now up over 700,000 members in Florida. We will hit 1 million after the first of the year. We're currently, this was as of June of this year, we were managing around 2,000 cases a day. Now those are the same patients over a period of time. We had about 2,000 open cases in Florida, and we'd done $37 million in savings for various Florida clients. Public sector is really, really important to me. While our company is headquartered in Dallas, and I've worn the title of managing director and chief network officer really since the company's rebirth in 2016, I'm a Pasco County, Florida resident. My daughter's in Pasco schools. To see this now impacting the schools there, Already this year, they've saved north of $1 million. And able to redeploy those funds to things that are critical to a child's education is really great to see. And that was largely spearheaded by the work done by Department of Management Services and the state to put our program in place. We continue to grow, won't spend much more time here, but large, well-known companies that kind of show that you guys were at the forefront. If you look at our growth, the growth has all happened since COVID. You guys put our program, unfortunately for timing, as a surgical benefit and right before COVID, which made the first year a little challenging, but we've gotten through that, and I think you guys were really ahead of the curve in putting in programs like this. How do we drive down the unit cost reduction? It's actually much simpler than people think. Last year, joint replacement through commercial plans, about 5.6% of the cost of that surgical episode of care went to the surgeon. So we have to be better with the facility. We like to be very truthful in how we contract. Our contracts are typically between 100 and 130% of Medicare. And you can go and you can look at plenty of studies and things that are published online that show that that's probably at least half of what the actual allowed amount is through the carrier. We're fortunate to have the state's claims data, so we know we're actually beating that in Florida. So reducing the unit cost of surgery by more than 50%. See kind of the trend, really kind of launched the program 2019, started 2020, we saved about $1 million, impacted about 83 members. Over the last 12 months, we've saved just in the last 12 months, $10.6 million for the state, impacted 573 members. And the number one reason they used us was because of the savings that they were able to realize. Number one trend we're seeing, though, is for much more complex, higher cost procedures that impact fewer and fewer members. Our book of business is tending to move toward a take-away choice mentality, still incentivize, still reward, but take-away choice. It's bariatric surgery, joint replacements, and spine surgery. It's about 0.5% of plan members that will have one of those procedures in a year, but it makes up 1/3 of your total surgical spend, which if you surgical spend is about 20% of medical spend, you can see really quickly how you can impact real dollars with very few members. And so in addition to that $10.6 million that we saved over the last 12 months, had those three categories been mandatory, there would have been an additional about $45 million of savings for the state. We think that's really interesting given a lot of the trends we're seeing. Yes, pharmacy is about 20% of spend. Yes, surgery is about 20% of spend. So is cancer. Cancer is about the scariest diagnosis anybody can get. It's emotional not just for them, it's emotional for their family, their friends. It is extremely complex, and it's a time where you don't know what to do. And so our program has added, and we love to add with the state in the coming months, our capability to provide this service for plan members. How we built this program, we brought in companies that had expressed an interest and said there's no real solution in the marketplace. And we spent 3 years and a lot of time with very intelligent, brilliant folks to help build something that would actually work. And so what we ended up looking at was, how do we help a member from start to finish? Early intervention, help guide them. So we brought on a team that are all work for us of, I think the least amount of experience, about 15 years of clinical oncological nurses to guide that member from day one, providing expedited access, think of it as within a week, into any one of the largest and best national cancer institutes, but then supporting them with a network of local providers as well, because it's not realistic for someone to, even from Tallahassee, to move to Tampa to be near Moffitt for the next 6 months. We need to get them a diagnosis there, then get them back home and embrace that care plan at home with the local oncologist and lead that navigation all the way through to, from start to finish. We found out quickly bundles aren't the way to do that, like surgery. You will spend more bundling in cancer because the provider has to account for the worst case scenario. Well, not everybody is the worst case scenario. Expert medical opinions are great, but if people aren't engaged early, they don't use them. And so we really built this to be a navigation-led tool with a nurse oncologist. Our nurses, on average with an engaged member, spend about 60 to 70 minutes per phone call It's not just with the member, it's with their family as well. Early intervention and detection is critical. 60% of women do not get their annual mammogram. It's because it's uncomfortable, and there's a tremendous cost associated with that. It's very uncomfortable. It's very stressful. Because for any woman who's gone through that, waiting 3 weeks for your results is absolutely terrible. We can do better. Bex is a novel mammogram alternative that actually, with something the size of a mouse, comes on site to you and will do your mammogram in a comfortable environment, getting results that are better than what they have been able to get through mammograms by using a different type of technology that can detect the mass down to about 0.4 to 4 millimeters. So very, very small before it has grown to something that you can actually feel. And this is something that we believe is critical as part of the solution. So given that, I'm going to take a seat and look forward to the conversation. But thank you again, Madam Chair and committee members, for your time spent on this important topic.
Mr. Burke, thank you so much for your presentation. All right, members, we're going to open the floor to questions. Vice Chair Lopez, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess my question is, and I may be speaking for some of the members on this committee and others, is how would a plan holder know about these savings? I mean, I had no idea these programs were in place. And I mean, I'm thinking to myself, if I needed to go get an MRI or have surgery, I would not have known about this or would not have known to look even at the options, right, of the savings plan. So like that, at least, you know, answered.
Yep, whoever can, you're recognized.
Thank you. Yes, member awareness and education is a challenge. And I think that what we found over time is repetition and through various channels is the best way to go. Can we do more of that? Yes. We as the program do that through webinars, through our open enrollment communications. We have required annual training for employees to try to help them. But many times it doesn't actually connect until, you know, they have a need and they go, oh, I think I remember something about that. So I think for us, the goal in partnership with our vendors here, and they may be able to speak a little bit more to what they also do, but just sort of constant communication and repetition.
Hey, Mr. Burke, did you have something additional? I saw you trying to speak up, so I just wanted to make sure you got your chance.
No, thank you. I think Sid is exactly right. I think we've learned. I think sometimes programs take time to mature. Working with any client and understanding their demographics, their patient populations, we've gotten better with communication. We've simplified communication. It still means we're missing 90-95% of people. And so I think data is the actual answer. If we can get to data that tells us when someone's engaging a surgeon, that's early in the process. Prior auth data doesn't work. It is wildly disruptive. It happens days before the procedure. You're not going to change somebody, but there's something called an eligibility verification that happens every time you go into a doctor's office. That tells us the MPI number, which can be routed to what type of doctor it is, and it tells us that a member is actually seeing that type of doctor. So there's opportunities to then do outreach that way, but you always have to be cognizant of that balance of how do you outreach without someone thinking that you're looking at them when they're doing something private in their life. So there are ways to do it, but I think it just takes time.
Follow up, good, Vice Chair? Good. Representative Chamberlain, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ma'am, and I apologize, I didn't catch your first name. I wanted to write that down, but I wanted to ask you a couple questions for clarification. On page 7 of your presentation, you stated that the programs had saved the state over $44 million. And I was just trying to understand, because if we scroll back up to, I think it's page 4, it looks like over the last 20 years, the state's premiums have tripled in pricing, and I'm trying to just wrap my brain around how we triple in pricing what we're paying out and how we're saving $44 million, and what that savings, so thank you.
Recognized.
Thank you, Representative. It's Katie Parrish.
Katie.
So, yes, I think the challenge with that is there are multiple variables that are contributing to the rising cost of healthcare. So even though we may be saving in this regard, healthcare costs do continue to rise in general, the pharmaceutical costs, as Healthcare Blue Book mentioned. So I think there's multiple components that are leading to those increased costs. While this is helping, I think that there's probably more to be done.
Thank you, ma'am.
I'll look.
Yes, and this next question will be for Bill, and it kind of maybe ties into the first question as well. It's just to help me understand it. Maybe there's a way for me to get a better understanding for my constituents of the cost factors that they, no matter what seems that we do, it just doesn't seem to be coming down, even though we come up with all these solutions to help it come down for them. If I'm looking at page 5, and I'm looking at all the orange there,
yeah.
Okay. It's mostly orange, right?
Yeah.
It raises a lot of questions for me because it shows a 500%, you know, price
difference.
Yeah, and
network difference in price, depending where people went for their actual service in your network.
And I'm curious, from a pharmaceutical standpoint, is a bulk of that orange due to pharmaceuticals?
Well, in the orange, I don't have it in front of me. Yeah. I presume you're looking at the joint replacement graph.
Right, but I mean, I think there was a mention in there that...
No,
I want to make sure I understand. Yeah, that's why I'm asking.
Pharmaceuticals are different, right? So that's not part of the program. We'll talk about that in a moment. But on the medical side, the facilities contract for, and it just depends on how they contract. They could be contracting on a DRG basis. They could be contracting on a discount off of billed charges, in which case the game is you run as many revenue codes as you can, and you just have different profiles for the amounts of services, the amounts of units of services that are consumed in any given joint replacement. It creates very, very different profiles for different hospitals in terms of the overall cost. That's what you're seeing reflected in that data. Consistently, if you use those hospitals that are at the lower end of the distribution, you will have a lower total overall cost for that joint replacement.
Right. So page 6, the next slide over, which shows the alternative version of drugs,
yeah,
could be 300-500% less expensive.
The same thing is happening in your PBM. So you have multiple medications in this example that one could take for ADHD. The alternative to any given medication could be half the monthly cost of the
So just so I'm clear, and I'm just wanting to know, so we have a 400-500% potential problem on the pharmaceutical side, a 400-500% problem potentially on the other side.
Correct.
As well, okay, thank you.
That's exactly right. That problem you see on the medical side is happening on the pharmacy side as well.
Thank you.
Good. Representative Steele, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you guys for the presentation. I just have a couple of quick questions. I'm not going to go down to the weeds. I have way too many questions to ask, but is this just HSA and self-funded problem? Because I mean, I'm in the industry, and so, you know, these DRG billing and is a huge issue, but these insurance companies, if you're not self-funded, they regulate all those costs. They have contracted rates with the hospitals. So they lower the costs through negotiations, but are you running this for anybody who's not self-funded?
The same problem happens on the fully insured side, right? Little itty bitty fully insured employers. Is that what you're talking about?
No, I'm just. Is what you're? Do you represent anybody who is not self-funded?
No, we do this almost entirely on the self-funded side. And what, just to be very clear, the benefit design doesn't matter. This in-network variability exists whether you're running a defined HDHP, CDHP program, or a conventional PPO. If you're using the same network, those negotiated rates that are happening in that network, whatever benefit design you lay over the top, are still happening. What I would argue is that if you have a conventional PPO, it is probably more important as an employer to actually do something like a shared savings, because there's no zero inherent incentive in a conventional PPO that's got like a $300 out-of-pocket max. Does that make sense?
No, I mean, I get it. I understand it. I think the biggest thing is most of these organizations that are self-funded don't understand risk, and so they go into the market without understanding the risk. But on the other side, you have organizations that are fully risk. Even the physicians at the primary care are at risk. And so they understand the negotiation part of it and the referral path. So it's a different market. But I just wanted to make sure I was clear. And that helps me understand all the other stuff.
And I'll tell you, over the years of looking at some of that data, right, because we have clients that exist in all different sort of formats, many of those self-insured medical systems that they abhor leakage. They want to keep everybody in the system. They do a pretty good job navigating internally. We see universities do this all the time to the most cost-effective location within their own environment when they're paying the bill. But that's not true. You're right, for a fully insured employer.
And then my last question is what's the average medical loss ratio that you guys experience with these patients?
Mr. Burke, did you want to jump in there as well?
Yeah, it's okay if I go back a step on one thing that I think is important to recognize is whether you're self-funded or fully insured, and we do, for the state, we do cover both populations. There's not an incentive or an alignment of incentive in any of those scenarios because in the fully insured, the insurance company's making up to their loss ratio of, they can take a 15% profit on premiums paid, right? So 85% of claims or $85 out of every 100 has to go toward claims. Well, keeping the cost down in the fully insured actually hurts your profits, doesn't change your margins, but definitely changes your revenue because getting 85% or getting 15% margin on $100 versus 15% margin on $1,000, so there's no incentive to keep the prices down in the fully insured population for the insurance company. And self-funded, they're not paying the claim. So it's just their ASO fee, which the more the claims go up, the more they have to pay. So I think it impacts both populations.
Yeah, I think the 15, and I'm sorry, Chair.
You're good.
I'm doing it again. I apologize.
Go for it. You're fine.
Just so you know, the 15% of the organization, that's like the plan. And then the 85% is the physician. That's why all those physicians are at risk. So they control the growth and the revenue.
I was talking about a fully insured plan in general.
Same. Okay, I'm good.
Good. And just a reminder, guys, I'm not going to make anybody go through the chair because I prefer the more conversational style. Just make sure we're not talking over each other and respecting each other. But other than that, Representative Williams, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Just one general question. We just had open enrollment here with the state. When you spoke of shared savings, is it open enrollment at all time, or there's a certain time period that you can actually join?
Thank you, Rep. With the shared savings program, it does not require any type of enrollment for the member. So it is available to all of our members all the time.
Representative Alvarez, you're recognized.
Hi, ma'am. Ms. Parrish, this one is for you. As I was taking notes and looking at the cost, it seems like premiums haven't gone up, but the cost to the state has gone up. So we're eating all the inflationary growth there? Is that what we're saying?
Yes, that's fair, yes.
Okay. We take that into account. Did we plan on, I mean, we couldn't have predicted the inflationary rate going as crazy as it is right now. I mean, are we okay?
I think we're okay. We do monitor that very closely. As many of you are probably aware, our benefits package for state employees is very enticing. It's a great tool for recruitment. So keeping those employee premiums low is very helpful in that regard. It is something that we're monitoring. We do project out through revenue estimating conferences to kind of keep an eye on those types of things. But certainly, while we're looking at doing more of these types of things and other cost containment measures to try to keep those costs under control.
So it's fair because, I don't know if I was going to make a statement or if I was going to ask you to make the statement through me there. You do see it as a recruiting tool to make sure that we have the best policies at the lowest prices, and that's how we're getting some of the talent for the state. That's what you're saying?
Yes.
And so it's worth the cost.
Yep.
Thank you. No further questions.
Representative Tremont, you're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So A question was asked earlier. I didn't have any questions at first, but Representative Lopez asked a question earlier. How would any employee know the cost savings program with these third-party vendors? And I don't think there was an answer in there. It seemed like what I heard was an acknowledgement of the issue and then explaining what we do now. You know, and I was very nice to Akka last time. I'm still going to be nice to you. But I don't really want to let anyone off the hook anymore, because I think what happens is far too often we ask questions, we get an answer, and it kind of just gets us through the question, and then we leave and there's nothing resolved from this. So I guess the question I have is there a plan to approve this? Who's going to oversee that plan and implement it? And what will be the quantifying measures that demonstrates improvement of that? Because clearly we acknowledge it's an issue. So what are we going to do after today to fix that issue?
Thank you for the question. I'll take that as a takeaway, if I may. I would anticipate that we would work with our vendor partners to identify additional ways that we can communicate and kind of get this in front of our membership population. I would imagine that we would our metrics would be around participation and utilization and things of that nature. So we can take that back with us, if you wouldn't mind, and follow up with you with some specifics.
So how, I guess, again, my you know, I appreciate that, but again, we're told stuff like this all the time, and nothing changes. So the first question I'd ask, how long have we known this is an issue, and why has there not been a plan developed already, and there's something in hand? Hey, this is what we know is an issue. This is what we are doing and what we have been implementing. How do we know that this is gonna get resolved? And which, again, is the same issue for all the other problems we have until we come into these committee meetings, and then we're asked a question, and then we're here next year asking the same ones.
Understood. I mean, we can definitely do more. We'll take that back. We do monitor when we see. We've seen steady growth in the utilization since the program's inception. So on some level, it's working. Can we do more? We can always do more. And so we do track and measure when we might see a spike in utilization. So I know that in past years, we've seen a spike when perhaps there was a mail out of some sort. And in other years, I think we've seen a word of mouth has been just sort of the greatest driver in utilization. But we can take that back and look at those metrics and circle back with you on any future steps.
I think if our vendors have any ideas as well, we'd love to hear them either now or in the future.
Yeah, I think 270, 271 file fees from the carrier are the easiest way to get in front of people. And it's something you can implement very quickly. You just have to get them to agree. And that allows you to intercept those members early in their journey by seeing that file feed that happens every single day thousands of times. That's an easy way to intersect, I think, very simply. But I think to Katie's point, we've seen a very steep increase, and it's been directly tied to a simplified message and frequency of communications.
I would add, we do continuous communication. We do open enrollment. We do games and contests to make folks aware. As part of that game and contest, we actually teach them how to shop, how to compare providers without having them understand that they're playing a game, right? They're going through it. It's engaging. We are consistently reaching out to people with digital engagement. From my perspective, our utilization as on the basis of our book of business, state of Florida is one of our highest performers. It always has been. It has gotten better year over year. We've gone from 5,000 rewards in the first year to over 11,000. So better than almost tripling of the engagement levels. So I think it's performed very well. I think more and more folks are being aware of it. And we are very, very consistent in terms of making sure we are continuously communicating. Now, we are also communicating, I suspect, on a far broader level of services. That includes MRIs and CTs and X-rays and all types of things, as opposed to simply trying to catch folks early in their surgical pathway. But I think it's all relevant.
Representative Gonzalez-Pittman, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your presentation. Mr. Burke, when you said that when you transform access to quality during these tough times, you really got my attention, and I appreciate that you understand how hard it is sometimes when you're going through the medical procedures. It's tough on families. It's just not the bottom line. There's lots of emotion. And in your page 19, you have a guide, access, and impact. Are you all using biomarker testing to provide access to specific care on cancer treatment?
Yes, in conjunction with partnership with Color. They've been doing it for a long time. They're very good at it. So we have the ability, again, today it's more about, for us, it's more about guiding and listening to the actual clinicians that are then seeing them at the best institutions. So yes, we have that. It's a partnership. We do not do it ourselves. We do not, on the oncology product, we're not even the payer.
Follow up?
I have several questions. Color is a genetic testing. It's not really biomarker. That once you have been determined that you have cancer or someone's been given that diagnosis, then you test the type of cancer and which treatment is going to be better. Color is a genetic testing.
Yep, and I apologize for mixing those two up. Okay. Definitely not a clinician myself. Right. But I do think the importance of having those best-in-class institutions that we get to skip the line access to can help with that. But happy to follow up with anything additional on that piece there to see if we have something in place for that.
Okay, and if you don't, would you be open to having biomarker testing?
We believe every one of our clients is a partner. Our programs today are built by our clients. So things we have today in our program that weren't there a year ago, weren't there 2 years ago, weren't there 7 years ago, were all built by listening to our clients on what their needs were. So we are always open to having a conversation and understanding whether or not we can impact that in a positive way.
And Ms. Parrish, is the state level, are we doing biomarker testing, since it was one of the First Lady's initiatives to have removing barriers to biomarkers? Do we offer that in our state package?
I know this is something that is very much on our radar, and we are researching that and looking into that and all of the things that come with it. So I may have to phone a friend if we're currently certain ones. I'd be happy to follow up with you with more information on that if I could, but certainly something that's on our radar.
It's not a follow-up, it's another one. Based on your presentation on, and it's that graphic on on page 5, it appears that the clinicians' cost as well as the anesthesia cost are very stable. And it happens that it's the facility cost where there's these huge discrepancies. Would you agree?
Yeah, correct.
And are we doing anything to control that? Because I heard in a presentation, you were talking about, well, what if doctors start creating more tests and more tests and more tests? Well, it appears that the physicians pretty much are stable, and it's the facilities, but I didn't hear anything talked about the facilities and what you're doing there.
So remember, these are all in-network prices. So rather than negotiating contracts or creating bundles externally with providers directly, which is what the surgery program does, we are simply reflecting the network that exists that the state is currently using, whether it's the Blue Cross Blue Shield network or the other networks. These are the prices that are in the network. Our job is to make use of the better value providers. I don't have any purview to alter the way in which they actually use resources during a surgery or the way that that contract is negotiated. What we can do is identify where the value is and help those members be aware and steer them towards the better value providers that are available in the network.
Okay, you said something that was really interesting. So you don't contract with the facilities. That would be through like the Florida Blues?
Correct. Yeah.
But it all starts with the contract.
Correct.
So you know what you would be paying.
Yeah.
And you just steer, you would help to steer the patients to better contracts.
No, to better prices that are within your existing network, right? So you've got providers, you've got facilities. Those facilities are in network. They have different rates that they're paid. We know that based on the claims that are actually paid for those services so that we can do a very good job of understanding whether or not they are among the most expensive or whether or not they are among the most cost effective, as well as whether or not they are among the most outstanding in terms of their patient outcomes. measured directly by what happens to patients when they go into those facilities for those surgeries, right? Not measured by credentials or other things, but actually measuring the outcomes of what actually happens to those patients when they're operated on by those physicians in those facilities and adjusting for the risk of those patients, right? Because you can have very good outcomes and have absolutely no complications and not operate on any risky patients. So we have to adjust for all of that when we think about quality and we look at physicians and we look at facilities. That's what we do to help navigate patients to better value within your existing networks.
Okay, so how would we control for the facilities? Because that's where there's a lot of cost. Is there a solution to that?
So on our solution, when we present results, let's just take the example of the hip replacement and the graph that's in the presentation. It's first sorted by facility. When we help show a patient where should you have this service done, it begins with the facility. Why? Because that's where all the cost is. That's the decision that you are going to make as a patient that's going to have the biggest impact on cost. Now, you can start with the doctor. You could look at the doctors. The problem is, if you remember that graph, docs work at multiple facilities. I call it the Tuesday-Thursday problem with a network. You see your doctor. They say, look, you need a surgery. You go to the front desk. They schedule you. They say, when do you want this done? You say Tuesday. Great. Doctor works at X hospital on Tuesday. That's where you're going to end up. It's $40,000 more expensive than the alternative if you set a different day of the week, and it has a completely different cost profile. So that is the work that we do to understand the performance of the network, to present that information, to layer it with the shared savings incentive, and then with our other clients, we don't do this at the state of Florida, but to provide the navigation and the concierge support that helps patients navigate, right? Because sometimes in your process, you may be aware that you should be shopping after you've selected your doctor and perhaps after your doctor has made an initial recommendation on where to go. You would be better off keeping that same doctor and using a different facility, again, on both a cost and an outcome basis. So that's what we endeavor to do to help patients actually get to the optimal location within the network that they have available to them.
Representative, I'm going to stop you right there. Guys, we're going to go ahead and start going through the chair because I think we're missing a couple of multiple answers that we could be getting. So, Mr. Burke, do you want to respond to any of Representative Gonzalez-Pittman's questions?
Sure. Surgeon-physician reimbursement has actually gone down almost every single year for the past 15 years. It's why we see consolidation. We've forced them to consolidate. So it's just we'll see costs come back up again every time they get employed by a hospital, or they have to consolidate to form a larger group so they have more bargaining power and negotiating power. We think you have to solve it through contracting. So we actually pay surgeons very fairly and very, very quickly within 4 or 5 days after rendering services. Cut out a bunch of the nonsense. There's so much that you can cut out and save so many dollars. Why is a hospital willing to take $15,000 from us for a knee replacement? Because I don't contract with every single hospital. I contract ones that will be willing to contract at a fixed rate. This is what you get. I don't care what you put on the claim, how many different line items of charges that you get a discount to charges on. No, we're going to pay you 15 grand. Manage that money properly and be efficient on a creative revenue basis. You should have plenty of margin there. It's probably a 30 or 40% margin, not a 200% margin, but there's a lot there. And so by keeping physicians reimbursed well, you can get the best quality physicians and in your network, and then take where you can grab waste out of it and pull it out and actually contract directly for those.
Representative Andrade, you're recognized.
Thank you very much. And you just touched on my slightly broader question of, have you seen your practice of focusing on quality and outcomes shifting the medical practice side as well? If I summarize this very simply, the focus of this discussion has been patient decisions and patient decision making. But have you seen the industry affected by how you're operating within it?
No. I mean, absolutely not. We have 5 million members. We'll do 20,000 surgeries this year. It's not nearly enough to have any impact. I think the reassuring thing is that good doctors, they actually don't treat based on what your insurance is. They don't treat based on, you know, whether it's us as the payer or it's Blue Cross or it's United. They're busy. Joint surgeons can do 6-7 joint replacements in a day, and they're bouncing between two ORs. They don't know which patient has what, so they've implemented protocols that everybody gets. I think that's the key to finding the right surgeon. But no, we don't impact near enough people to see, to have any type of positive impact on the industry as a whole today.
I look at it on a market basis, and we do have evidence that providers come back to the table with the carrier when they see their MRIs and their surgeries disappear. If we can move enough of those surgeries, it gets the attention of the consolidated providers, and they come back and they endeavor to negotiate lower rates, and we've seen that in quite a few markets.
And I apologize if these are both very broad questions, but on the most of these are seem like non-emergent decisions, right? Things that are not critical. I know from my personal area of the state, there's a growth in ambulatory surgical centers, and part of that is competing or trying to get around some of that CON that still exists in Florida regarding like transportation. What are some of the, if any, big hurdles from like a CMS that you, if there are any, that you think might hinder your ability to provide better services or expand on what you're doing right now?
Happy to answer it. I think luckily CMS decisions don't necessarily impact us at all. We can do what's current, what's logical today. I think joint replacements today, a shoulder replacement isn't eligible in an ASC by Medicare, but on January 1st, it is. It's 2 months away. Why aren't we doing the appropriate patient in the surgery center? I think the key thing around surgery centers is differentiating between freestanding ambulatory surgery centers, freestanding ERs, freestanding urgent cares, all very different. I think ambulatory surgery centers tend to very much align around cost and quality reduction, cost reduction, quality improvement. Not 100% certain on the others, but we definitely see a migration happening, and it's very, very real. The increase in cases being performed appropriately in a surgery center, it's a good thing.
Follow up, go for it.
Are there any data sets, any pieces of information that, because y'all depend on obviously information to craft your decisions, but are there any pieces of information that you're having a difficult time getting from facilities or physicians or providers at all that would improve your product?
Difficulty on everything, absolutely. The best we get is probably with the state of Florida, because you all put your foot down, wrote legislation requiring the carriers give us data that helps us. I think there's more we could do. There's always going to be pushback, but yes, absolutely. From a hospital, I mean, there's hospitals, good luck finding their price transparency. Right? I mean, you got to go through 80 different clicks to hopefully find it, and then it's a machine-readable file. Who knows how to use that? Like, not the everyday consumer. So, yes, it's hard to get data out of the healthcare system in general, but we've been very fortunate here with the state to be able to get more than we get from most clients.
I probably have a little slightly different view on that just because we've been doing this for a long, long time. There are specific carriers, I think, that are difficult. In terms of obtaining claims data, I think we're doing a lot as an industry to handle that to some degree on a federal level, particularly entitled to in some of the pending legislation in the U.S. House. We are one of the largest aggregators of those machine-readable files. We do not spend a lot of time on the hospital files, but we do ingest most of the machine-readable files. They are not great, but they are improving, and I think there's probably room for improvement. And again, in some of that pending legislation, it's going to take a little while for that to get through. All of these, these are sort of generational problems. Like I said, I've been doing this for 2 or 3 decades, and the data tends to get better over time. The one area, at least on a federal level, that I think improvement can be made is the cost and the ease of accessing some of the CMS data, particularly the carrier file and the QEP. That's not an issue for the state of Florida. But I do think that data liquidity is improving. One area that I suspect that y'all run into is getting data out of EMRs in a consistent way. That might be panel data. That's not administrative data that actually has the patient values and things in that. But I do think it's getting better, by and large.
Ranking Member Costello, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I'd like to say thank Ms. Parrish for coming up to my office this afternoon. He answered a lot of my questions. I really only have one. And Mr. Burke, in your presentation, the breast cancer and colon cancer. The colon cancer, they have that kit, Cologuard, I believe it is, where you can get sent to your house and you send back the sample for some detection. This breast cancer detection system here, this is the first I've heard of this. Bexar, is that, am I saying that right? Why aren't we advertising that more?
Because it's not part of the state program today through us. It's something we're looking to put in place, redeploy some of the savings that have been generated through the Surgery Plus program and redeploy them to parts of our program that are expansions of the existing program.
Follow up?
Through the chair. Thank you, Chair. You gave a percentage of that, a woman who don't have mammograms because of the discomfort levels and all. Wouldn't this process here save lives, if not money?
100%. And it costs $225 for an exam. If you compare that to the average cost of a mammogram, it's not close.
Thank you, Chair.
All right, members, we have a couple who would like a second bite at the apple for questions. But before we do that, is there anybody who hasn't asked a question yet who would like to? No? Good to go. All right, Vice Chair Lopez, you're recognized.
I just wanted to follow up. Thank you so much, Deputy Secretary, for making an effort to come up with a plan that answers Representative Chase's follow-up question to my question. I would probably say you could start at the legislature. Make sure all of us, obviously those of us on this panel, or on this committee, have heard the presentation and now are very aware of the benefits. But I would say start in the House and the Senate and then move your way out. We'll certainly make sure our staff knows, because I think they are probably not aware, certainly my staff was not, to these savings. And quite frankly, I think it's a great program, but if it's not used by most of us, then it is for naught. Thank you.
All right, Representative Steele, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the second bite. I never got the answer for the medical loss ratio. What the medical loss ratio was before the two solutions were installed and then after.
Yeah.
I know you can't answer the before, but they I mean, you might have the before.
Yeah.
If I may, if we could follow up with that information, I'd be happy to provide that.
Right. Follow up?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chair. Going on, I don't have glasses on, so is that six? Or is that nine? That's nine. Nine. On page nine, you talked about joint knee replacement being at 0.32 versus 8% being the industry average. Are you doing a bed day or like a per thousand rate so that you guys have equal numbers that you're comparing, or is it just straight math?
How we do that is we actually pulled about 15 different clinical journals that use the same definition of a complication that we used, because it's wild how everyone's definition is different. Right. And so it's a return trip to the ER, a readmission into the hospital, or second procedure following, or an infection. Those are what we looked at, and then we just looked at those studies and said, what did they find as the average? And then we look at what is ours. So it's not perfect. We'd love to get more. I think with volume, with more we do, the more we'll know. But directionally, I think it's statistically relevant enough for it to matter.
And then, so we backed into pricing on hospital contract rates, just so you know, we had enough data to do it. So are you just using the data that you're getting from the HIE from the state?
When we show savings, it's looking at the exact same episode of care in that market. So it's geographic specific on a bed weighted basis. So how many people are going to each? And that gets us to what we believe to be a very accurate number. And then it's been audited both by the state. We also had a third-party audit those savings, and we found every time they come back and say, the savings look good, so I'm guessing we're probably being very conservative in our view of the carrier allowed amount for the exact same procedure.
Okay. And then one last, sorry. Spend on tech versus healthcare. How much are we spending on the two products per person per month? Is it a PMPM? How is it calculated?
The fees do work a little differently for each of the different types of contracts. It's a negotiated fee. There are some price guarantees in there to ensure savings built in. Be happy to follow up with the specific pricing.
Follow up?
No. Thank you so
good
much.
Good to go.
I'm done.
Any additional questions, members? All right. Seeing none, Mr. Burke, Secretary Parrish, Mr. Campine, thank you all so much for being here and for taking our questions and participating in the discussion. And members, wonderful discussion today. I really appreciate it. There's no further business before this committee. So with that, Ranking Member Casella moves with rise. Without objection, meeting adjourned.